Although tuberculosis cases are rare in this country, it remains one of the world's deadliest diseases, accounting for 9.4 million cases and 1.7 million deaths in 2009, according to the World Health Organization. And in recent years, new strains of totally drug-resistant TB have turned up in Italy, Iran, and just last month in India. So we thought that we would find out more about the disease on this week's Please Explain. And we're joined now by Dr. Neil Schluger, Professor of Medicine, Epidemiology, and Environmental Health Sciences at Columbia University Medical Center and Chief Scientific Officer for the World Lung Foundation. A little later, we will be joined by Maren McKenna, science journalist and author of Superbug, to focus on drug-resistant tuberculosis. Welcome to our show, Dr. Schluger.
Thank you very much.
And we invite our audience, if it has any questions, anyone out there, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. What causes pulmonary tuberculosis, Dr. Schluger?
Well, tuberculosis is an infectious disease. It's caused by a very slowly growing bacterium called Mycobacterium tuberculosis. It generally, as you alluded to, generally affects the lungs, although it can infect any part of the body. It's spread almost entirely by the airborne route, so you inhale the bugs. It's not spread by sexual contact or blood, casual contact, touching, saliva, any of those things. So you inhale the bugs. Most people's immune system will be able to contain those bugs and set up a state of what we call latent infection, and most people will never develop the active form of the disease. But about 10% of people with latent infection will go on to develop active pulmonary tuberculosis symptoms of fever, cough, weight loss, generally.
In the 40s and 50s in New York, we saw a lot of tuberculosis, and I was told usually it was because people worked in close quarters or lived in teeny tenement apartments, and so they would infect each other. But even then, not everybody got it.
That's right.
What happened here? Was it simply that we came up with treatments that stopped the spread of it in a city like New York?
Right. I think there are two things. People talk about the social determinants of tuberculosis, things like poverty, malnutrition, and overcrowding, which were common certainly in tenement housing. And those social conditions improved. And at the same time, there was the introduction of effective drug therapy for tuberculosis beginning in the early 1950s. As a result, with a very notable bump in the late 80s and early 90s, TB rates have gone down in New York and in the U.S. Fairly steadily for a long time. The rate of TB in the United States is among the lowest rates in the world.
In those days, in the old days, they used to send people off to sanitariums in Arizona or on mountaintops in Switzerland. Did that really work?
Well, I think the effect of the sanatorium movement, and there was a very famous one upstate New York in Saranac Lake, the effect of that was, I think, mostly to remove those people from society where they could spread the infection around. Certainly, fresh, cold air is very pleasant, but it does nothing to cause tuberculosis. It's a cure tuberculosis.
If you have a latent infection, can you still spread the disease?
No, you can't, and that's a very important point. The reservoir of latent tuberculosis around the world is enormous. The WHO, World Health Organization, estimates that there are about 2 billion people with latent tuberculosis in the world, about a third of the world's population. As I mentioned a moment ago, about 10% of those people will go on to develop active TB, but while they have latent TB, they're not sick, they're not contagious. They can be treated to reduce the chance that they develop active TB, but they can't transmit the disease when it's just in that latent state.
But once it begins, does it always begin in the lungs and then spread to other organs if it's left untreated?
That's by far the most common way that disease develops. 85 to 90% of the time, it's a lung disease and will generally stay confined to the lung. But TB can infect the bone marrow, the liver, the brain, the kidneys, all parts of the body, really. But most of the time, it's a lung disease.
It was once called consumption and the wasting disease. Is that because of its symptoms?
Exactly. The cardinal symptoms of tuberculosis are cough, fever, and weight loss, and literally it seemed as though the body would consume itself in this febrile state and people would sort of waste away, and that's why it's called consumption.
And they got gaunt. And then how long does it usually take before the infection turns fatal if it's left untreated?
Well, tuberculosis, generally the symptoms will develop over a period of weeks to months, and it will generally, in an untreated form, take months for someone to die of tuberculosis. In a sense, that's the good news because it gives you a long time to find those patients and start treating them, but untreated patients, generally it will take many weeks to several months before they might die of their infection.
I'm talking on today's Please Explain with Dr. Neil Schluger, Professor of Medicine, Epidemiology, and Environmental Health Sciences at Columbia University Medical Center and Chief Scientific Officer for the World Lung Foundation. Do we know how long this disease has been around, when the first infections were?
Well, tuberculosis is an ancient disease. There's evidence from mummies from thousands of years ago that they had tuberculosis. It was known to the ancient Greeks. The word in Greek for consumption is phthisis, and phthisiologists are tuberculosis doctors. So it's a disease that's been known for thousands of years. The cause, the actual bacterium that causes tuberculosis, though, wasn't discovered until the late 1880s by Robert Koch in Berlin.
Is it also found in animals? I was wondering if it's passed between humans and animals or animals and humans.
There is a form of tuberculosis that's found in cattle, for example. It's caused by a very close relative of the bacterium that causes disease in humans. But in general, it's not passed from animals to humans. There are cases, maybe about 1% of cases, where persons drinking unpasteurized milk from sick cows can develop usually an intestinal form of tuberculosis. That's quite unusual. And so generally we don't think of it as one of these diseases like avian influenza, for example, where disease is being passed from animals to humans.
Well, there was an outbreak in 2005 traced to raw milk cheeses from Mexico. Can you explain a little bit about how epidemiologists trace sources of outbreaks like that?
Well, whenever there's an outbreak of an infectious disease like tuberculosis, epidemiologists will go and interview all of the patients and see what sort of characteristics they have in common. You know, did they share the same living space or workspace, or were they exposed to the same air supply? Or occasionally, did they all eat food from the same source? And so sort of very thorough examination of all those risk factors will be done, and one hopes that a clue will turn up as to the source. But as I said before, foodborne acquisition of TB is really unusual. It's mostly by the airborne route.
And it's been largely eliminated in this country, or totally eliminated?
Not totally, but the rate of tuberculosis in the United States as a whole is about 3 cases per 100,000, and that comes out to something like 11,000 cases in the United States as a whole. The rate in New York City is maybe 2.5 times that, but if New York City were a country, it would still have one of the lowest TB rates in the world. You know, if you look around the globe, as I said, the rate in the U.S. is 3 per 100,000. If you go to India and China, the rates are between 150 and 300 per 100,000. And if you go to sub-Saharan Africa, the rates are between 500 and 1,000 per 100,000. So relatively speaking, we have a very low rate of TB in the United States.
And why is that? In some other countries, for example, India has a very low rate of polio these days, but it still has a lot of TB. You would have thought that if people are vulnerable to one, they'd be vulnerable to the other.
Well, it's a great point, actually. I think there are several causes. First of all, for polio, there's quite an effective vaccine. And for TB, we really lack a very effective vaccine. The other reasons, though, are related to poverty and overcrowding and malnutrition, which are common in poor countries in the world. In the United States, in a sense, we've had the best of all possible worlds. We have a relatively healthy, well-nourished population, and we have access to all the latest diagnostic tools and drugs with which to treat TB, all those things are challenges in low and middle-income countries around the world.
Now, why haven't we been able to develop a vaccine for tuberculosis? Has it been tried?
Well, there is a vaccine for tuberculosis called BCG. It's actually the most widely used vaccine in the world. About 100 million doses per year are given. It has some efficacy in preventing very severe cases of TB in young children, children under the age of 5, but it doesn't seem to do much for anybody who's older than that. It turns out that it's just an enormous scientific challenge. There are people working very hard on better TB vaccines, but TB is a very clever organism. It's not clear how the immune system defends itself against tuberculosis, and so the scientific challenge of vaccine development is enormous.
And children are especially vulnerable to it because of their undeveloped immune systems? Is that why TB is one of the leading causes of death among people with HIV/AIDS?
Right. So in sub-Saharan Africa, where HIV infection is so common, HIV is really the fuel for the tuberculosis epidemic. HIV really affects exactly the part of the immune system that the body depends on to defend itself against tuberculosis. And so persons with HIV infection are extremely vulnerable to TB.
We're going to bring in Maren McKenna, a science journalist and author of Superbug, in just a moment. But before we do, just one question. What does it do to the lungs? Does it destroy tissue? Is it similar? Does it have the same kind of devastating effect that emphysema might have or lung cancer?
Well, tuberculosis can, if it's left untreated for a long period of time, it absolutely can destroy the lungs. It causes cavities, holes to develop in the lung. And in cases where the disease is not treated for a long period of time, it can cause tremendous destruction and scarring and pulmonary insufficiency. The good news for most patients is if they get diagnosed promptly, they can be treated and cured with relatively few consequences for their lung function.
We are talking about tuberculosis on today's Please Explain with Dr. Neil Schluger, Professor of Medicine, Epidemiology, and Environmental Health Sciences at Columbia University Medical Center and Chief Scientific Officer for the World Lung Foundation. And now we are joined by Maren McKenna, science journalist and author of Superbug, to discuss the rise in drug-resistant tuberculosis. Welcome to our show, Maren.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And a reminder that we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Blended Lopate, and this is Please Explain. When, and I throw this question out to both of you, when were the first drugs developed to treat TB? And we talked about sanitariums before. Was that the only way it was treated before that, before the drugs?
Well, yes. The first antibiotic to treat TB was streptomycin, which was identified by Selman Waksman at Rutgers University and first tested in the late 1940s. And then isoniazid, which is still a very useful drug, came in early 50s, and it was over a period of about 30 years that all of the drugs we have to treat tuberculosis today were developed.
And why are they all that different? Or are they all pretty much the same? Are they very different, or are they pretty much just variants on the same thing?
No, there are several different classes of anti-tuberculosis drugs, and we know that TB can't be treated with only one drug. It needs multiple drugs at the same time. But it brings up a very important point, which is that there hasn't been a novel class of TB drugs introduced in about 40 years. We know, as I mentioned, that drug therapy is the only effective treatment for TB, but there haven't been new drugs developed, and that's mostly a matter of straightforward economics. Tuberculosis is a disease of poor people. The total global market for TB drugs is estimated to be only about $300 million. And if you're a drug company, you want to invent something like Lipitor, which last year had $12 billion in sales. You don't want to invent drugs that are only going to generate you a couple of hundred million. So there's really been no new drug development in TB for a long time. There are a couple of things in the pipeline, but nothing has been approved new for TB in about 40 years.
Are they expensive to manufacture?
The drugs we have now to treat standard drug-sensitive TB are pretty cheap and can be afforded just about everywhere in the world.
And do they have any side effects?
Lots. TB, as I mentioned, you start off with four drugs, and then it can often be narrowed down to two drugs. Disease needs to be treated for a minimum of 6 months, and the medicines do have side effects, particularly they affect the liver, and they can make people a little nauseated. I mean, the treatment can be done safely and satisfactorily the vast majority of the time with good nursing care and support, but it's a lot of medicine for a long time.
Marin, Dr. Schlueger has pointed out that no new drugs are being developed, and yet we have these drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis turning up. Could we come up with new antibiotics? Is that the problem, or are these resistant to every kind of antibiotic?
You know, I think this is a really important point, not just for TB, but really for the entire problem of antibiotic resistance, which is that when people hear the phrase drug resistance, they think, oh, well, okay, it's resistant to the drugs we have now, but surely there's going to be another drug. And the reality is there is no other drug, not that there could not be another drug, but that no one has produced one. Because, as your other guest said, it's not cost-effective for antibiotic companies, drug development companies, to make. Could there be another drug that would be effective against highly resistant tuberculosis, or for that matter, other drug-resistant infections? Sure, there could be. If someone wanted to invest what's necessary in terms of time and millions of dollars to invest, but it's not an easy thing to do.
Well, you would think that even if you didn't make a lot of money, there would be other rewards. KP, one of our listeners, points out on our show page that the first antibiotic effective against TB was discovered at Rutgers University by Dr. Selman Waxman. He isolated streptomycin from a soil microbe, and he won the Nobel Prize.
Well, it would be nice, probably, to have a Nobel Prize, but you know what? Nobel Prizes go to individuals. Drugs are made by drug companies. What drug companies want are returns from for their investors. You make a lot more money making something that people take every day of their lives, like a statin or a diabetes drug, or every weekend, like Viagra, than you do with a drug that contains the seeds of its own destruction, because if you use an antibiotic properly, the disease goes away.
And then you I guess then you get all the money from it until you have to turn it over to some manufacturer of generics. So I'm not so sure that's the worst thing in the world. Let's take a call from Aaron from Westchester. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, we're hearing some stories of these drug-resistant forms of tuberculosis. I was just wondering, in what particular countries are we seeing the highest rates of drug-resistant tuberculosis, and how can we go about protecting ourselves, and how are people going about trying to contain these forms of drug-resistant tuberculosis if they're resistant to so many of the normal drugs that we usually give?
Right. Well, it's a very good question that raises a lot of points. World Health Organization estimates that there are about 500,000 people with multi-drug-resistant TB. And by multi-drug-resistant TB, we mean TB resistant to at least the two best drugs that we have. So the estimates are about 500,000 people. A lot of those people are in Russia and the former Soviet Union. In those countries, I just returned from Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan has about the second or third highest rate of multi-drug-resistant TB in the world. So Russia and the former Soviet Union have a lot. But multi-drug-resistant TB has been reported from just about every region in the world, and I think the scariest thing is that we probably don't really have a good idea, because most countries where TB is common are very poor, and those countries don't have the means to test every strain of tuberculosis for drug resistance. So a lot of what we're dealing with are estimates, and I think it points out a real problem in TB. You know, it's an old adage in public health that until you can measure something, you can't do anything about it. And right now, we can't even measure rates of multi-drug-resistant TB accurately because countries just don't have the equipment that they would need to do it, the kind of stuff we have in the U.S. At the moment, there's very little multi-drug-resistant TB in the United States.
And why is that? With globalization, you would have thought that we'd be seeing people coming in with drug-resistant TB and passing it on to people here. Why is that not happening?
I think eventually that could happen. I mean, we do have, a really good TB control program in the U.S. and in New York. But I think that's the concern that, certainly from Central Asia to Eastern Europe, cases are beginning to spread from Africa to other parts of the world. I thought the other day, I just caught up with the movie Contagion. MDR-TB is sort of like Contagion in slow motion, you know. So I think the concern is these cases could spread.
A listener, Landa in New York, writes, George Michael, pretty famous person, had some TB strain that he, a wealthy Westerner, said was touch and go. He said that the doctors who treated him in Austria were very prepared to treat his severe strain of TB. But if George Michael could, unprepared, if George Michael could nearly go, what does that bode for other people? Are you aware of that story?
No, I'm not aware of George Michael's case, although lots of well-known people throughout history have had TB, lots of famous artists and writers, and Eleanor Roosevelt died of TB. Nelson Mandela had TB when he was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of people can get TB. It doesn't really respect income or background.
What Ed from Great Neck asks, what generally triggers TB from its latent to its active state? Is it just our immune system is weakened, and so this is an opportunistic illness?
Certainly, in many people it is, HIV infection. Many people now take drugs for a whole bunch of legitimate reasons that have the side effect of lowering one's immunity, malnutrition. Sometimes, though, TB will go from the latent to the active state in otherwise healthy people, and we don't really find an underlying immune defect. But certainly, we focus very carefully on people who we know have immune suppression.
Now, Maren, can you tell us about the discovery of totally drug-resistant tuberculosis in India in December? Is it the same strain that we've seen in the former Soviet Union and in Iran and Italy?
This is a really interesting story. So just to recap, these 12 cases in India came to light first because some of the physicians who treated them at a hospital in Mumbai, which is a very good hospital, it's a World Health Organization reference hospital for tuberculosis, described 4 of these cases in a letter to a medical journal, which was published immediately before Christmas, and most people missed it, including me, I must admit, at first. And they described these 4 people, later figured out to be 12 people, who had what would have been multi-drug-resistant TB, which is not uncommon in India, that became totally drug-resistant, resistant to all drugs available to treat it, because of the way they were mistreated, incorrectly treated by the physicians they went to originally, who didn't recognize what was going on. Now, we now know there were earlier cases in Iran and in Iran's border areas, and as I wrote about yesterday, a couple of cases in Italy, both of whom died in 2003. Now, when we say, is it the same strain? That sounds like, did the women in Italy somehow give this identical TDR-T and identical TDR-TB to people in Iran who gave it to people in India? And that's not what's going on as far as we know. What's going on is that these cases are created by bad treatment, by inappropriate drugs, drugs that don't work, or inadequate courses of drugs, or people not being able to keep up with the fact that to cure these things, they have to take drugs correctly for 2 or more years at a time. That's what forces the emergence of totally drug-resistant TB. However, that's not to say that it always would be created by inappropriate treatment. There's no reason to believe it would not spread in the way that other TB spreads.
We are going to take a little break now and then come back with more of today's Please Explain discussion of tuberculosis and also drug-resistant tuberculosis, with with Maren McKenna, a science journalist and author of a book called Superbug, and Dr. Neil Schluger, professor of medicine, epidemiology, and environmental health sciences at Columbia University Medical Center and chief scientific officer for the World Lung Foundation. Give us a call, 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We're back with Dr. Neil Schluger, professor of medicine, epidemiology, and environmental health sciences at Columbia University Medical Center and chief scientific officer for the World Lung Foundation, and Maren McKenna, science journalist and author of a book called Superbug. We're talking about tuberculosis on today's Please Explain and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. And let's get right to some of those calls. Gabrielle from New York, you're on the air.
Yes. I have just completed a year and a half successfully of medication for Mycobacterium avium complex, which is indolent tuberculosis, and it has now been found in the last 15, 20 years in otherwise healthy elderly women. It used to be a major cause of death of HIV patients. So I wonder what that is, if there's any new research on that, and why only elderly women.
Dr. Schluger, do you know?
Yeah, well, Mycobacterium avium is a different species of bacterium from Mycobacterium tuberculosis. It can cause a chronic lung disease. We generally don't think of it as transmissible in the same way that tuberculosis is. The caller is exactly right. It seems to be much more common in older women. The treatment can be very difficult, and it's an enormous, becoming a bigger and bigger problem that pulmonary physicians see all the time now. And the treatment is difficult and very prolonged and often not successful. But that disease is completely distinct from Mycobacterium tuberculosis, from TB. It's not spread the same way and doesn't seem to represent the same public health threat that TB does.
A caller from Manhattan asked, 10 years ago she got tuberculosis and went through a year of treatment. Can she expect new side effects to arise 10 years on?
Chances are no. After a successful course of treatment for TB, there is a relapse rate of 3 or 5%, but most relapses will occur within a year, 2 years at the most, after completion of treatment. So someone who's 10 years down the line, if they had a good response and didn't have a lot of scarring in the lungs, should be just fine.
Maren, you mentioned that you wrote about some of the latest developments in Wired.com. What's been the response of your readers there? Is there a growing concern about drug-resistant TB, or do people see this as something that really affects the citizens of other countries?
You know, actually, I've been fascinated by how much our readers have responded to this. That initial story on India reporting completely drug-resistant TB was pushed along on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn thousands of times. And what there's a couple of interesting things going on there. The first is that, you know, at Wired we exist at the intersection of tech and culture, and people are really interested in scary diseases. But the second thing is that I think people are really beginning to understand how we are all at risk of emerging infections, and tuberculosis really is a re-emerging infection. The reason for that is because we live in such a globalized world. Now, it's true, as you folks talked about just a few minutes ago, that we have protections, for instance, when people are first immigrating to this country, we do health checks on them and so forth, but there are very large numbers of us, including me, who go back and forth across borders to different countries all the time, and are exposed to diseases without knowing it. And I think our readers feel that they really feel that risk acutely now.
And that's, I think, one of the questions of our next caller. Vic from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, yes. Thank you very much for taking the call. I was just curious if there are any kind of precautions one might take, you know, things to avoid, you know, not drinking bottled water that has been opened up right in front of you, for instance, things like that?
Well, TB is, as I said earlier, transmitted almost entirely by the airborne route, so you don't have to worry about water or food or those things as a way to get TB. In the United States, the chance that you're going to contract TB is very low. If you're traveling around the world, places where TB is common, one thing is that TB, although it's transmissible, is not as transmissible, let's say, as something like chicken pox or probably even flu. It takes a little bit more prolonged contact. But if you were going to visit someone who you knew had TB, you or the person you're visiting should have a mask. Better to be outside with the windows open than in a closed, confined space. But the reality is that there's not much you can really do aside from not going to visit a TB hospital to protect yourself against TB.
I want to jump on that because one of the things
I just want to comment on something Ms. McKenna said, because I think it's incredibly important. One of the things that TB really lacks is an advocacy community. The amount of money that's spent by governments and NGOs and philanthropies on TB is not close to being enough. And in fact, things like the Global Fund to fight TB, malaria, and HIV and other things are really going underfunded. And I think it's really hurt the cause. So, each year is, you know, for people like Ms. McKenna and others who are writing about this, because I think it's one of the critical missing pieces. There's not enough attention being paid. There's not enough advocacy.
And your blog is the Superbug blog at Wired.com.
That's right. Wired.com/WiredScience/Superbug.
Let's go.
I want to jump on something that Dr. Schluger said, which is that when people go abroad, when they get prepared to do trips, particularly the kind of trips to the developing world or the kind of adventure travel that increasing numbers of people do, they tend to make the assumption, oh, well, I'll just get a shot. And then, I'll, you know, once I'm vaccinated, everything will be fine. The reality is there is no good vaccine for tuberculosis. There's one that's used in some parts of the developing world for children, and it's actually used in India. It's not one that we use in this country. As far as I know, there is no adult vaccine for tuberculosis, and people in the research community consider that a critical lack.
Let's take a call from Larissa. Hi, Larissa. You're on there.
Oh, hello. Well, I was a child in DP camps in Europe at the end of the war, and where TB was around, and I didn't realize I was touched by it until a routine checkup here in the States, where it was shown that I had some kind of lesions on my lungs. So I wonder, is that something that could rekindle itself, or am I done with it?
It's always hard to give specific medical advice over the phone, but there are some people who can have tuberculosis, a relatively mild case, and it will, the body's own immune system will sort of handle it. If there's evidence of a scar on an X-ray that looks like old TB, and the person was never treated for it, it might be worth getting some preventive treatment, but that's something you should consult your individual physician about. Chances are you're going to be fine, but ask your doctor.
Thank you for your call. Carolyn, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I have a question. My mom had tuberculosis in the 50s. She died at 48, and I subsequently have to always have a chest X-ray instead of just taking the Tyne test. I'm a school teacher. And I always have to follow up a Tyne test with a chest X-ray. And my son contracted a tuberculin meningitis, when he was two. And my mom kind of always blamed herself, saying that she thought it came from her. Is it possible that we had that bacteria because she had tuberculosis?
It's possible that I would guess likely that. Your latent infection was from exposure to your mother.
Okay.
If you have latent infection, though, you cannot transmit tuberculosis to anyone else.
Okay. And will I develop tuberculosis because of it, or is it likely that
it in somebody who has latent TB?
What would trigger the active form?
Yes.
Sometimes it just happens, but often it's some weakening of the immune system, as we said before, infection with HIV, or a person takes drugs like prednisone for another medical condition, and prednisone can weaken the immune system. There's evidence that ongoing cigarette smoking increases the risk of going from latent to active TB. Poorly controlled diabetes weakens one's immune system. So other medical conditions like that. Most people who are going to get active TB will get it within a couple of years after they develop their latent infection, though.
Okay, thank you so much. I guess this answers the next question Ada left on our show page. What about people who are resistant to TB? I had a grandfather who was able to work with TB patients since he seemed to be immune to the disease. That just meant he had a strong immune system?
Yeah, so people like that would be fascinating to find because we don't exactly know what it means to be immune to tuberculosis. We don't know how to tell. There's no simple blood test to tell if someone is immune to TB. There do seem to be people like the listener's relative who've been exposed repeatedly who never get TB, and we'd love to understand the biology of that more than we do.
Let's take another call. Stephanie from Fairwood, New Jersey.
Hi. Yeah, hi there, yes. Yes, you know, I'm a nurse practitioner, and I work in an employee health setting at a hospital in New Jersey. And we, as part of the pre-hire process, we test everybody for PPD, PPD skin test. And I find that pretty much all the patients I have who are immigrants from another country, you know, a lot of them have had the BCG vaccine as a child, and, of course, they test positive for PPD. And at that point, we need to offer them, you know, the isoniazid and B6 as prophylactic treatment. A lot of them are concerned because they think that the positive PPD is only because of the BCG. So my question is, how long does that BCG last? How long will that cause a positive test? And how strongly should we recommend that these people get the 9 months of INH and B6?
Okay. I'll answer in a general way. A positive skin test, you can get a positive skin test from having BCG, although generally that positive skin test will wear off after someone's about 5 or 6 years old. Nonetheless, you can get false positive tests. I think the best thing in that situation is to use a different test for latent infection. There are now blood tests called interferon gamma release assays. Their use has been endorsed by the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, particularly for people who have had previous BCG. You should not get a false positive result with that test. And I think that's the test to use in people who have had BCG vaccine.
Now, Marin, we hear about antibiotic resistance developing because we're using antibiotic soaps. Our animals are getting antibiotics in their feed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is that something that is playing a role in the development of these new strains, or is there something else at work here?
So, you know, what drives the emergence of antibiotic resistance is the combination of evolution and natural selection and the overuse and misuse of antibiotics in a whole bunch of different settings. And it's completely correct in general terms to talk about the overuse of and misuse of antibiotics in agriculture as a driver of resistance in a number of bacteria. But as far as I know, not in this particular case. In the case of XDR and TDR-TB, MDR-TB as well, what we're talking about is the misuse and inappropriate use, and in some cases underuse, of antibiotics given to humans by physicians and other healthcare workers. It's the poor treatment that's driving the emergence of these strains.
Do doctors in this country, are they knowledgeable enough to spot what's the problem and what to do about it?
You know, that's an interesting question, because what it really gets to is how aware are people, are physicians out there in the community, that this health problem is burgeoning and is crossing our borders.
And we have to leave it there, unfortunately. But thank you both so much for being on today's Please Explain. Marin McKenna, science journalist, author of Superbug, and also a blog on, and Dr. Schluger of Columbia University Medical Center. Thank you both.